Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to another episode of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I'm Pat Johnston. And unlike the Michigan Republican Party, I guarantee an engaging and entertaining time without it becoming a kick in the balls. I have to say, growing up in the 80s and 90s, the Republican Party always tried to portray this air of superiority as opposed to the rabble-rousing, bleeding-heart liberals. They truly believed themselves to be sages and true intellectuals. I mean, you remember the yuppies of the 80s. Michael J. Fox's character from Family Ties was the wannabe yuppie. What was his name? Alex Keaton, right? He read the Wall Street Journal, wore a jacket and tie, and thought of himself above everyone else because he was a Ronald Reagan conservative. I mean, that was the whole William F. Buckley act that many right-wingers tried to emulate back in those days. I mean, he sounded intellectual, and therefore, that probably had to mean that he knew more than those pesky liberals and their unions, civil rights, gay rights, feminism, and stances against corporate greed and endless needless wars. William F. Buckley was smart, so he knew all. That's what columnist George Will's whole act was about, too. He could use big words explaining why corporations and rich people just needed more tax breaks while everyone else just had to deal with it. He also didn't believe in those know-it-all scientists and their climate change studies. They were just scientists who worked for a living as scientists. George Will, though, was a conservative columnist. He wore a bow tie, after all. He had small glasses, which, in his book, canceled out anything that those scientists had to say. The right wing was filled with all these nauseating blowhards and their fake intellectualism, which was just all dress up to fight what they truly were always against: progress. That's right, progress, be it social justice, economic justice, environmental justice. The right wing has always been against it. Back then, they made it seem cool by appearing as intellectuals to cover up for what the right wing has always been. I've had discussions with people who argue that Trump ruined the Republican Party. No, 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 no. The Republican Party and the right wing in general were always the Trump Republican Party. Trump just exposed or put a spotlight on what they have always been. Rush Limbaugh was heralded as the new intellectual leader of the right wing for years, and corporate media loved him. He specialized in reactionary politics and the politics of white victimization. Blame black people, blame brown people, blame young people, blame teachers, blame women, blame colleges and universities, blame the entire media, and blame everybody for everything that you view is wrong for America. Gin up just a few white people to get outraged or afraid, and maybe, just maybe, the rich and corporations can gain more of a foothold in this country. Anger and fear, anger and fear, anger and fear, that is what they live on. Turn on any right-wing podcast, radio show, or YouTube channel, or wherever, and the politics of outrage, fear, and resentment are always a common theme. Now, I'll never forget, in one of my final few months at my last terrestrial radio job, how angry some of my station's right-wing listeners had become over migrant children staying in Alma. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with the story, the Alma City Commission back in 2021 voted to allow around 50 migrant boys from the U.S. southern border to live in a refugee center, a center being run by the Grand Rapids-based Bethany Christian Services. Now, the migrant boys, ranged from ages 12 to 17 years old, were put through a heavy vetting process by Bethany Christian Services, or BCS, and once they arrived at the center in Alma, which is located in Gratiot County, right in the middle of the mitten, the boys received medical care and were eligible for so many other things, such as vaccinations, including for COVID. The center provided food service workers, therapists, teachers, clinicians, and more for these kids. Now, you'd think a Christian group providing some shelter and relief for refugees really wouldn't be a big deal. I mean, I'd say they were kind of acting like, you know, Christians. But that caused an uproar within the city of Alma, as right-wingers did everything in their power to stop the process. WCMU reported on how opposition groups calling themselves Citizens Against and We the County were utilizing right-wing immigration talking points in their efforts to thwart these kids from coming to Alma. One of the members told WCMU that his group feared gangs infiltrating the asylum process to establish drug running routes and getting special treatment off the largesse of the American government. Whew, scary. Now, these boys were fleeing from violence and economic oppression. That's all. And there's a Christian group doing all it can to accept them and to give them food and comfort. The right wing always claims to be on the side of Jesus, but their actions, like in this example, shows once again they are anything but. Anyway, the city commission okayed the project, and a recall effort against the commissioners who voted for the center essentially failed. But it showed me once again how the right wing is completely bonkers, but also how the right wing is just sad. So getting back to my terrestrial radio time, I was board hopping for the longtime radio host at this Saginaw-based station last year, and the host would usually go on some long rants about how much he respected Trump for trying to do something on the immigration front, even though Trump didn't really do anything except separate kids from their children. And one day last year, he took a few callers about this center in Alma, and that got me on the mic, because I just had to ask him a question, because I said, I don't understand the controversy, and I needed him to kind of help me out on this one. And he asked me, what did I mean by that? And I responded by saying that I don't get why bringing 50 migrant boys to Alma was causing such an uproar, considering it was a Christian services group who wanted to help them. In fact, I even said how the Christian group was acting, and he finished my sentence for me by saying, you mean Christian? And we had a chuckle over that. We did. But he was right. He was reading my mind, and he knew I was right. So I pressed him again to explain why some people would try to stop boys from receiving care in a Michigan town, an American town, where we pride ourselves on caring for all people. Now, he stammered a bit, but I will give him some credit. He eventually and truthfully said that he guessed people were against it because they feared something bad would happen. And I responded, well, how sad is it to live in such fear over this, and that it's even more sad how people can be consumed by such fear. It reminded me how I once interviewed this right-wing woman years ago over immigration in Michigan. Her big argument back then was that they'll be bringing in diseases, and we can't have that here in Michigan. Yet, just about 6 years later, I have a strong suspicion that this same lady and many of her friends were just outraged over the COVID lockdowns and have still refused to get the COVID vaccine. Or maybe she's not alive anymore, I don't know. You see, the Republican Party has nothing to offer people but fear and anger. They embraced Rush Limbaugh's rhetoric to help win elections. Fear and anger worked there for a long time. And then they embraced Trump for speaking the Limbaugh language they so eagerly celebrated for decades and gladly voted for Trump. I heard the Trump rhetoric for years in corporate right-wing talk radio. It wasn't new to me. He wasn't the first one to use it. All Trump did was exploit it and expose it for the whole world to see. And after he won, the entire right-wing felt emboldened to say what they were too afraid to say for years. But once they lost in 2020 and lost Michigan in 2022, some Republicans were trying to go back to the faux populism, faux intellectualism of the past. You see, some in the Republican Party, both nationally and on the state level, are learning that by being overt racist, homophobes, transphobes, xenophobes, and freedom phobes, it ain't exactly working. Like here in our state of Michigan, not only did Trump lose in 2020, but during his regime, Republicans lost the governor's seat, the attorney general's seat, the secretary of state seat, a U.S. Senate seat, but even more, the right-wing's sudden boldness to not just use dog whistles whenever they try to utilize white victimhood, but to use blowhorns and truck horns to speak of their fear for the other, that electrified the very progressive movement they hoped to stamp out for good. It was progressive activists who felt the urgency of now, who felt sudden boldness, who were generated to bring in some change to Michigan that the country had failed to achieve in Washington. Progressives got expanded voting rights and independent redistricting on the ballot, and both of those passed. They found ways to circumvent the crooked Michigan Republican Party, which gerrymandered districts, guaranteeing them power to block any real meaningful change. progressives felt suddenly emboldened to join in the fight and run for various seats across the state, and especially in our state legislature. And thanks to the Republican Party's embrace of the crazy, Democrats scored the trifecta in 2022, keeping the governor's seat and gaining the majority in both state houses. Oh, and the people voted out Trump in 2020 as well. Can't forget that one. But despite all those defeats, the state Republican Party failed to re-examine and wonder how it could begin winning elections again. Well, you know what, actually, they did re-examine and decided to double down on their craziness. They put in the prime nut job of them all, Christine Caramo, as head of the party. Now, she lost in her race to unseat Jocelyn Benson for Secretary of State. In fact, she got trounced. But Caramo still refuses to concede because she knows her race had to have been fixed. See, she lives in such a QAnon, right-wing Facebook and Twitter bubble thread that she does not live in reality, but neither does the Republican Party, and it hasn't for years. Now, there are some within the party who's upset with Caramo's so-called leadership, and so state Republican Party committee members met in Clare to discuss how Caramo is directing and spending and raising party funds. Oh, but it turned out to be a little bit more interesting than that. John King from Michigan Advance reported on how the exclusiveness of the meeting angered some, including Wayne County Republican James Chapman, who tried to open up a door into the conference room of the hotel there in Clare. Now, King says in his reporting, Mark DeYoung, chairman of the Clare County Republican Party, told the Detroit News that he was attacked by Chapman when he opened up a locked door that Chapman was trying to open. He kicked me in the balls as soon as I opened up the door, DeYoung told the news, adding that Chapman then slammed him into a chair, breaking his rib and requiring a trip to the emergency room. Chapman alleges that DeYoung took a swing at him first, prompting him to remove his glasses. And this is what Chapman then had to say, quoted by the Detroit News, "When you see me taking off my glasses, I'm ready to rock." Such manliness within the Michigan Republican Party. This follows up another incident which happened at the same hotel in Clare back in April when Macomb County Republican Secretary Melissa Palis and Kalamazoo County GOP Chair Kelly Sackett got into a bit of a fight. It was a proxy fight between a Caramo supporter and a Matthew DiPerno supporter. DiPerno, of course, lost to Attorney General Nessel in 2022 and then lost to Caramo for the state party chair months later. So they're just fighting with each other all of the time. This is who the Republican Party has always been, an embarrassment to Michigan and to the country. And just as we're seeing how some Republicans in the state are trying their best to tamp down the voices of their most ardent supporters, we just learned on Tuesday of this week that the entire Michigan Republican congressional delegation has announced its allegiance to Lord Trump. That's U.S. Representatives Jack Bergman, Bill Huizenga, John James, Lisa McClain, John Molinar, and Tim Walberg. In fact, I have to say, I love that my congressman, John Molinar, decided to show his true colors by including his name in this endorsement. It just shows that he's a weak, effete, ineffective, and a joke of a man. It also shows that John Molinar doesn't really appreciate democracy, and he really doesn't appreciate Michigan. As the awesome progressive nonprofit group known as Distill Social wrote on Twitter, the transition is complete. From party of small government and law and order to the grab them by the blank party. And this is the party that Rick Snyder and his rich buddies want to put back into power? Again, this is who the Republican Party has always been and always will be. Their entire agenda, or whatever you want to call it, is just bad for Michigan, which is why we have to keep fighting for what is right. They stand for nothing. They offer no solutions to help people, as I will illustrate both in my last call segment here in a bit, but also in my upcoming discussion with Democratic State Representative Betsy Cafia of the 103rd District in the Traverse City area. Representative Cafia is a true progressive fighter who's been making a difference in helping get important progressive, or better known as common sense, policies across the finish line and on to Governor Gretchen Whitmer's desk. We'll talk about the many, many ways progressive Democrats in the legislature have already passed and are working to pass policies that'll help Michigan and her people for decades to come. You are listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
I I'd like to give a weekly shout out to my good friend Rich for all of his work on setting up leftoflansing.com, and please check it out. I post other thoughts on the news of the day, plus you can hear my Left of Lansing short, which I post every Friday. Plus, I've got a full archive of all episodes of the podcast there as well. That's leftoflansing.com. All right, the Democrats in the State House didn't waste any time once they grabbed a hold of the majority for the first time in four decades, and while they have passed some pretty historic and pretty progressive legislation, they have more work ahead of them this coming fall. Joining me for the first time here on the podcast is Democratic State Representative Betsy Cafia. She represents the 103rd District, which is a newly redrawn district. Leland Isle, Traverse, and Benzie counties are all part of this district, which also includes, of course, Traverse City. She serves on the Higher Education, Health Policy, and Economic and Small Business Committees, plus she is the Vice Chair of the Families, Children, and Seniors Committee. She's played a key role in getting some recent strong common sense policies through the legislature, and she continues to fight to pass more bills to help Michigan progress into the future. State Representative Cafia, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you, Pat.
I apologize. I just want to throw this out there real quick. I apologize for mispronouncing your name in previous podcasts, but I have to say, judging from some interviews and news stories that I saw on YouTube from the past, it seems like I might not be the only one. So
you are not the only one. My last name is a little tricky. If we were on camera, I would have you gesture with your hand, Cafia. You can sort of get the emphasis on the fee, and you sort of wave your hand in the air like, that sort of helps people remember, but the emphasis is on the fee in FIA.
Before we delve into what is happening in both Traverse City and Lansing, I just wanted to ask you, because I just did a little reading about your background, that you have a journalistic background.
I do.
Is it true that you started in the newspaper reporting business when you were just 19?
That's correct. Yeah, I was a sort of very young reporter for a county newspaper up here in northern Michigan. And they sort of gave me a trial period of 3 months to see if I was any good. And then they kept me on. I was in local weekly news journalism for 6 years, and I was promoted within that newspaper company when I was 20 to the editor of a small weekly newspaper up in Antrim County, the Elk Rapids newspaper. And that really, I served for several years. Proud to say I won Michigan Press Association awards for our class of newspaper every year. But that was such an important early experience for me because as a young person, it gave me this front row seat to sort of the infrastructure of how communities work. I covered school board, township, city, county government, and interacted with like the Army Corps of Engineers on harbor issues, civic groups, school board. It really gave me, again, sort of a front row seat on a lot of the invisible infrastructure that helps make our communities work or sometimes gets broken and it doesn't work as well.
Did you see yourself back then being a lifelong journalist? Was that maybe your original dream or was it just something you were just doing there at the time?
So, I mean, I have always loved reading and sort of the written word and loved journalism, but this is, I'm 45 now. So that when I got into journalism was right as the internet was sort of taking hold much more. And I loved the work, but I could see that the print news industry in particular was going to get increasingly challenging with that competition of free media on the internet. And why I left journalism, actually, I went back to school, put myself through college, worked a couple of jobs to do that. But some of what I experienced as a journalist, covering especially really troubling child abuse court cases and such, and seeing sort of some of the more challenging things about life, I wanted to do more than just write about it. And so that sort of propelled me into going and getting my degree. I got a bachelor's in social work and worked on children and family issues, which then that propelled me over time into moving into politics.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you one more question on this topic, because I feel like that you are qualified to answer this question. If you had one criticism about news reporting today, or maybe how about this? If you just had some advice that you could give to some young reporters there, what would that be?
I think my overall take right now is I would say this isn't just for reporters, young reporters. This is for our communities. The Fourth Estate is critical. Having a free and fair journalistic arm in our country is incredibly important. And it's been sad to see how many like local and regional papers have dried up. People need to support local journalism. They need to get a subscription to your local paper, participate, and try not to be too hard on reporters, because it was hard 20 years ago when I was in the biz to try to cover all of the things, but it's gotten that much harder with fewer resources and cutbacks. So they do a really important job. I take them seriously. I think they should take their role seriously, because hopefully in a democratic society, having accurate information that is presented in media and news is just absolutely vital.
You bring up a great point. My last radio job, when I got there in 2007, it was out in Saginaw. The news department had about, I'd say, 6 to 7 people. And then when I left, it was down to about 3. I think you're absolutely right about that. You've lived in Northern Michigan your whole life?
So I was born in Indiana. We moved so don't hold it against me, everybody. I'm not a lifer in Michigan, but we moved to Northern Michigan when I was 5 years old, and I have mostly lived in this region. I did spend a brief period for a job out on the West Coast, lived in Eugene, Oregon, working for a social research center as a research interviewer, but came back right around the time Rick Snyder became governor and a lot of really bad things started happening in my home state. I came back to try to be a part of pushing back against that. And so, yeah, I've lived in Northern Michigan for most of my life.
What do you love most about your district?
Oh, there's so much to love. I mean, the low-hanging fruit here would be obviously the geography. We're right on the Great Lakes. We've got amazing sand dunes. I'm a big nature person, so hiking and things like that. But I'd have to say, I love this community. The people here are really remarkable. They're very engaged. And I wouldn't be in my position in Lansing if it had not been for an incredible amount of community effort. We knocked 45,000 doors. I was one of the top, if not the top, Democratic caucus fundraiser last year. And the vast majority of my fundraising came from people in my district. So we're just very invested. We care about our community and making it better. And I love that about us.
If you don't mind me asking you, what made you eventually decide to get involved into politics?
Sure. Some of it is my own personal background, and that ties into the social work. I come from a very blue collar working class family. We did not grow up in Traverse City. We're over in Kalkaska County, very much a struggling low income community. And it wasn't because my folks didn't work hard, but we always seemed to be one of those families that was paycheck to paycheck. And so we didn't always have regular access to, you know, healthcare, dental, things that just every family really should have in the wealthiest country in the world. So that very much shaped me, seeing how hard my parents worked and some of the struggles we had. And that's probably what fed in part into going into social work and working as a Head Start social worker with a lot of families, much like mine in the 3-county area up here, who were just working their tails off many times, but low wage jobs, often no parental leave when they would have a baby, right? Paycheck to paycheck and just the struggle of that. So interacting with systems that I felt and frankly, political leaders, I'll never forget organizing a roundtable with some of our local state house and Senate members at the time with these Head Start parents who were, again, working 3 jobs. So they sacrificed a lot to be there. And they were talking to these political leaders about some of the challenges they were dealing with and trying to raise these young kids in the wage they made and things like that. And one leader at the time, he's no longer in politics, but was literally looking at his phone the whole time, kind of obviously not paying attention. And I will never forget how angry that made me, how disrespectful that was. So I think over time, seeing that these are the attitudes of some of the people who make policy that make my family's lives better or harder, I decided I would work as hard and do the best job I could. And I could maybe do a better job than the guy who kept checking his phone.
Right. All right. Well, listen, let's move into some things here. I know that your town made a bit of noise here this week as a hair salon owner announced on social media that her business would no longer welcome transgender or queer people in her business. The Facebook post that she posted said, and I quote, "If a human identifies as anything other than a man/woman, please seek services at a local pet groomer. You are not welcome at this salon, period. Should you request to have a particular pronoun used, please note we may simply refer to you as hey you," unquote. All right, so you gave an official response, but I was just wondering if you could expand more on your stance that this hair salon owner's viewpoints are not what Traverse City is all about.
No, it's horrifying that a business owner in our community would feel emboldened to say something like that, comparing our LGBTQ neighbors to animals. And she later doubled down and compared them to pedophiles. So this is a really serious and concerning thing, because we're at a time when acts of violence against targeting people for their identity, LGBTQ folks in particular, is on the rise. And so to, as a business owner, add fuel to that fire and dehumanizing people is really troubling. I do not believe she represents the majority of folks in Traverse City or our community, but I hold the Supreme Court deeply accountable with this recent decision because I think it has given a lot of people in the country the impression that they can say the quiet part out loud if they truly have bigotry in their hearts toward other Americans.
Right. No, and I was going to just say, I mean, I feel like after that Supreme Court ruling, I mean, this was inevitable that things like we were going to start seeing things like this. And that's sad, but true.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want us to go back to an era where people are posting signs in windows of what kind of people are not welcome here. Right. We've lived through that as a country. People worked so hard in the civil rights movement and gay rights movement, et cetera, to move us forward. And so we're at a very serious time. And I think good people who do want us to move forward and be accepting and respectful of all people need to become more vocal in a kind way, but in a firm way, because a lot of loud, hateful voices are dominating the space. And that has real consequences. I had a young trans woman come to a recent coffee hour, and she was visibly fearful, but had the courage to stand up and talk about how these upticks in crimes toward people with her identity who are LGBTQ, and asked me what I was going to do to try to help keep her community safe. And I talked about expanding the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, which we have voted to do. I talked about banning conversion therapy from state licensed therapists, which we also have done. But I think we all, not just policymakers, have a huge responsibility to make sure that we're loving our neighbors as ourselves and looking out for their well-being and safety.
You mentioned the expansion of the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, which includes protections against discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. Can that prohibit this salon owner from discriminating against LGBTQ plus Michiganders, or is that just going to have to be worked out in the courts? I mean, what's your
take? Again, because we just passed that right in Michigan, which it was long overdue. Traverse City has a non-discrimination ordinance that prohibits this sort of thing within the city limits that was passed with a huge citizen margin like 15, 20 years ago. But the Supreme Court has opened this can of worms, this Pandora's box of questions that are now going to have to be litigated about what local and state ordinances and laws to protect all people from hate-based discrimination. What now? So it is going to end up being litigated in the courts. And that is a really unfortunate thing in 2023.
Absolutely. You know, I did see that that salon owner is learning that there are consequences to their actions, though, because as a hair products company, I guess, announced that it's refusing to do business anymore with that owner. So I am coming to the conclusion here, Representative, that, and I think you'll probably agree with it, that no matter what the right wing legislatures in other states might do or whatever this right wing Supreme Court majority does in the end, I think the culture will still set the standard. And that's where I think Democratic Senator Mallory McMorrow is correct when she says hate will not win. And when Governor Whitmer declares bigotry is bad for business in our state. And yeah, I really do hold that.
I hold that too. But at the same time, Pat, I will point people to, we have a single seat majority in House of Representatives. My district flipping and coming into the Democratic majority this past year by less than 800 votes helped deliver this one seat majority in Michigan for the legislature. Elections matter. And so it is our individual actions on a day-to-day basis as residents of Michigan to look out for each other. But make no mistake, we have to turn out and protect and defend that majority in 2024, because we could easily slide into some of these other states' situation if we lose a progressive majority who actually does want an accepting and welcoming Michigan. So we shouldn't take that for granted. They started spending against me in January of this year before I'd even found where to hang my coat. They were already running digital ads and mail, and they're doing so on all of us, the most sort of the front line, if you will, with the narrowest margin. So people should not sleep on 2024. It's incredibly important. If you want to see this progress, we have to show up, we have to invest, we have to work hard, and we have to build. Progress is not inevitable. It's really up to all of us.
I agree 100%. And that is why I think like news, like I just saw this week where CNBC unveiled its America's top 10 states for business or top states for business, and Michigan moved up that list and is now 10th in the nation. Here's how I would argue it then to other people, those on the right and independents, is that I think that just pretty much is vindicating the Democratic Party's position that bigotry is bad for business, that we should be more welcoming. Not only will that bring younger people and other people to the state, but I think that will also attract businesses here as well.
You know, a lot of these large companies that are employing, have good paying jobs for folks, they have diverse workforces and they want to set up shop in states. They want to do business in states that are not going to intimidate and make other half of their workforce. So it is absolutely a smart move. I know Governor Whitmer, of course, as you said, so bigotry is bad for business. That's not just a slogan. That's very true. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Pat, one of my biggest focuses to make sure that Michigan is a state where everyone feels welcome is they need to be able to afford to live here. So housing, childcare costs, right? Well-paying jobs, those are things that I'm really focused on. They're major issues in my region and across many parts of the state. So we are dug in deeply understanding that we need to have welcoming policy, and we also need to sort of have the infrastructure and supports for people who want to move here and people who are already here to be able to stay and thrive.
You brought up childcare, and I've read some economists say that that would be one way to attract younger people here to the state, especially younger families, is that if we focus more on childcare and made it more affordable.
Right.
Is that something that the Democratic Party has already focused on or will focus on here in the near future?
So it is. And this is a really important difference in sort of, I guess, focus when you have Democratic leadership. We look at it, I think it might have been Elizabeth Warren who called it the care economy, care infrastructure. Sorry. It's not hard infrastructure, right? Like roads and bridges, but having adequate access to childcare in particular and care for our seniors, et cetera, that is part of a care infrastructure that is vital. And so the good news is the governor has been leading on this, even when she did not have a majority in the House and Senate. They created a program called TriShare, which partners with businesses and workers, and the state pays a third, so the businesses pay a third, and the families pay a third to really bring those costs down. That was piloted in her last administration and is continuing and expanding. You know, of course, she's implemented expanded pre-K options for families. And then I actually just got some state funding for an $800,000 award for helping childcares in my region start up, because there are a lot of startup costs and hoops to jump through. And we lost a third of our childcares in Northern Michigan during COVID. So this has had real ripple effects to the point that my Chamber Alliance that covers my region's businesses has it as one of their top policy priorities for us. So we are looking to help support these small business owners in building a viable model, as well as trying to bring down costs for families. You know, investing in our families is a critical part of a successful economy and a successful state. And I think we're on the right path with lots more work to do.
You just mentioned the word investing. And I believe the budgets which the Democrats passed, both the omnibus and the education budgets, were filled with ways to reinvest into the state and reinvest into the people. I was wondering if you could maybe just give a brief overview about those budgets and what you're most proud about when it comes to those budgets.
It's hard to do a quick run through of a 1,200-page document.
Yeah, I know.
I can hit the highlights. It's a pretty transformative budget. I'm incredibly proud of it. We invested nearly $400 million additional dollars into our schools for mental health and school safety at a time when we know our kids are dealing with a lot of mental health distress. It's a really important investment, right? We have historic amounts of per pupil funding. One thing that I'm particularly proud of is a project of mine. So if you don't mind indulging, I'll talk to you just for a second about how this works. So rural school districts, there has been an inequity that is longstanding when it comes to state funding for large geographic rural school districts. And it impacts all across Michigan, but certainly Northern Michigan where I live. Basically, rural school districts, while getting no extra money to cover this from the state, have been driving hundreds of miles bus routes. And so spending as much as 10 to 14% of their budget in some cases on gas and bus costs. So this is before the child even steps into the classroom. I was at an event last night with a principal who was talking about how here for TCAPS, which is one of the largest school districts, he was having to sort of do bake sales to help pay for AP Gov classes so that his students would be as prepared when they went to for college, you know, application and exams as some of the students from downstate school districts that had really excellent advanced placement classes. And he was telling me last night, it had a lot to do with just not having equity in this transportation funding, because all of that money that should have been going into the classroom was having to go into the gas tank. Some of my school districts, Benzie Central, they drive the equivalent of Northern Michigan to San Francisco in a single day for their bus route. If you just, I mean, it's a couple hundred square miles. And Kalkaska County, where I grew up, this was such a severe issue. They ran out of money and closed early when I was in high school and reopened with no busing in a 400 square mile school district. So just unbelievable hardship for families trying to drive their kids to school every day. So that was a long explainer to say I tackled this one when I got here because it's been talked about by politicians my whole life. And I'm really proud to say my first standalone policy bill had a tiered per pupil per mile equity formula proposal. And the school aid fund chairs, Regina Weiss and Darren Camilleri, who are both former public educators themselves, they heard me out, they worked with me, and we actually got that into the school aid fund budget, a new equity formula to provide for rural transportation. So all of that money that was going into the gas tank, we now can divert back to the classroom, more field trips, more art, more music, more mental health FTEs, and really investing in kids in rural Michigan and making sure that all of our kids are getting the best possible education. So I'm really proud of that one because in my first 6 months, I got to take a big whack at a problem that's been around for pretty much my entire life.
No, that is important that you brought that up because I felt like I had read so much about that budget and I missed that one. So that is that is so important. And that,
well, that was my baby. So
that is awesome.
About, you know, it's like you wouldn't think about it unless you're literally in that rural school district driving those buses and squinting at those numbers and being like, gosh, how do we make this work? So I don't think it was ever an intentional oversight, but it was a true decades long inequity. And we now have a formula that it doesn't completely rectify it, but it gets us a long way towards that. So I'm very proud of that.
I know that you're part of the Higher Education Committee, and I saw a study by the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center that found that spring enrollment in Michigan dropped by about 2% this past year. I was wondering if you could talk about how this budget maybe addressed that concern, because I think in order to keep and attract younger people here, we have to compete by having a stronger higher education system.
So yes, I am proud to be on the Higher Education Committee, and I especially like that assignment because the college where I went and put myself through school for my associate's degree before I got my bachelor's, Northwestern Michigan College, is right here in my district. Fantastic school. Some of the things we're doing to address increasing student enrollment in our colleges and universities involve lowering the age of the Michigan Reconnect program, which is a tuition-free option. If you live in the county where the community college is located, you can get tuition-free studies there for most programs, a wide variety of programs, and it also applies to trade school to help get more of our folks getting their associate's degree, getting their certificate. We know the numbers bear out that, you know, you make higher earnings in that case, and people to stay in Michigan, they need to be making, you know, enough money to afford to live, right, and to make a good living. Lowering the age to 21 from 25 was a big step forward to help get more people in the door and getting those degrees and certificates.
My last question for you, and I have so many things I want to talk to you about, but of course, time always flies, but this is something that just intrigued me, and that's I've been wanting to ask you about it for a while. You introduced a bill that would give 16-year-olds the chance to register to vote. I think it's House Bill 4996. And if you could, would you mind telling the audience a bit more about this bill and what you hope to achieve from it?
Sure. So just let's be super clear. 16-year-olds will not be able to vote under my bill.
Right.
What it does is pre-register them. Currently in Michigan, at 17 and a half, you can pre-register so that you're all set to go when you turn 18 and are legally able to vote. The 18-year-old age to vote would not change under my bill. What this would do is allow them at 16 years old to pre-register and get in the pipeline such that when they turn 18, they are all set to go. And as they're busy, right, getting ready to move off to college or start trade school or go into the military or move on with their life with a job, and a lot is going on at that age, it's easy to forget to register to vote. And then suddenly you've missed your first election. There's all kinds of research to show that if you get people in that habit as first-time voters when they're 18, they're more likely to make it a lifetime habit. So this was something that came to me from clerks suggesting it. And also a lot of folks in the education field pointed out that at 16, young people are really opening up to the political world, to civic engagement. They're doing AP Gov classes, they're volunteering, and they're really tracking a lot of times with what's happening politically. So this is a way to get them into the pipeline sooner so that they're queued up and ready to vote when they're 18. Other states have done this where we would be sort of in the middle of the pack to join if we pass my bill. It did pass the House, by the way, just before the break. But the stats show that anywhere from 2 to 14% increase in voter participation when you have 16-year-old pre-registration. So this will just increase young people engaging in the political process. Jocelyn Benson, I'm proud to say, you know, after I put my bill forward and she's texted me a news article and said, this is one of the most important pieces of voting rights legislation to get passed for ahead of 2024. So with somebody I respect a lot in the Secretary of State, thinking this is really important. I'm excited to get it done through the Senate.
Democratic State Representative Betsy Cafia. Representative Cafia, I just want to tell you that I think you're doing some great work. I always preach on this podcast. What I love most about progressives is that they're always proposing and passing policies designed to help people, designed to make the state or the country or the town, whatever, a better place to live. And I think you are a perfect example of all of that. And I hope that you will consider coming back sometime in the future.
Absolutely, Pat. Thank you so much. I think of it as New Deal Democrat. We are here to make all boats rise. We want to make Michigan a place where every person, no matter where you are, what your zip code, what's in your bank account, that we're going to have your back and we're going to work hard to make sure that you can thrive in our state. So thank you for having me.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com.
That was a great discussion there with State Representative Betsy Cafia. She's one of the many strong progressive voices that we have in our state legislature by just trying to do what's right for both her constituents and for the state of Michigan. And talk about perseverance and endurance. I mean, not only did she get through that brain tumor surgery, but despite losing a state house race 3 straight times, Betsy Cafia came back and won after a 4th try. She never lost hope or gave up. She kept fighting during those losses because during that time, she was elected to the Grand Traverse County Commission because she wanted to fight for those who still needed a voice somehow in some way. And that meant on the local level, which is key because as Darrell Slaughter from the Natural Resources Defense Council said on this podcast about his time on the Ingham County Commission, he said that some of the most innovative ideas happen on the local level. However, as we've been learning here on the podcast, that's exactly where the right wing and its money people are turning their attention, and they pulled off some victories in both Livingston and Ottawa counties. So, while national races and even state races garner much of the attention and much of the electoral excitement, it's really at the local level where change can happen, either good or bad. Let someone like Betsy Cafia serve as an illustration of never giving up the fight and doing whatever you can for the common good. Time now for the Left of Lansing Last Call. Earlier, I talked about the state Republican Party and the Republican Party in general, which has really nothing to offer except anger and fear, anger and fear. To prove my position, I have 2 quick examples to illustrate my point. Here's Republican State Representative Phil Green, who represents portions of Lapeer, Genesee, and Tuscola counties, and he was on Tim Skubick's Off the Record show last week. He was asked by Craig Mauger of the Detroit News to name 3 planks that Republicans will run on in next year's election in their bid to take over the state house. Listen.
We're going to be running on, look at the stuff that's been done. Look at the radical agenda that has been pushed. And this is what happens when we give 100% unfettered power to one party. So looking even at the budget, look at what has happened in the Eagle budget, where the budget was almost doubled. We put across the budget, 649 and a half new employees, and it was a spending spree. I believe one representative called it Christmas in July. And at some point, we're going to have to go back in like was done in 2010, 2011, and be adults in the room and get the budget back under control. I think another issue that we're going to be looking at again in the Eagle budget is what happens with all of the carbon offsets, the carbon monitoring, and how is that going to affect everyday Michiganders who are trying to make bills meet and their utility bills keep going through the roof because of policies that were enacted over the past 2 years?
Okay, now you notice that he didn't offer any solutions there. He used the term radical when trying to describe the Democratic majority's agenda, that agenda being reinvesting in Michigan's working class, her children, her schools, her environment. Yeah, I know, real revolutionary thinking there, Phil. Also, something tells me that Green never minded when Republicans had complete control during the Snyder years. And interestingly, he talked about the increases in spending in the Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, also known as EGLE. Now, this increase will be used for such things as pipe replacements, contaminated site removal, stormwater management in local towns and cities, and also for dam management. And as the people of Sanford may say, that might not be such a bad place to spend some money. But Green also had the temerity to complain about high energy costs, which didn't happen overnight. They didn't start overcharging once Gretchen Whitmer got into office. DTE and Consumers Energy have been raking in the cash as Michiganders pay the 12th highest rates in the country. What exactly did Republicans do during that time to reverse that trend? Were they telling DTE, no, we don't want your campaign bribes, and that they'd hold the utility company accountable for long power outages and expensive bills? No, they did nothing. But again, notice that Phil Green had nothing substantive to offer when asked how Republicans would make a Michigander's life better. Now, let's hear from Republican Tom Barrett, who's back running again for the 7th Congressional District. Now, he lost to Democratic Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, who's now part of that growing field of Democrats running for Senator Debbie Stabenow's seat. Now, here's Barrett being asked by political reporter Rachel Louise Just to discuss the important issues he wants to focus on. Here you go.
It's a real threat that we have to take seriously. Now, that's not the only threat we're facing, but we have to stop that influx of illegal entry into our country and illegal drugs coming into our country that are poisoning more and more Americans every day. From there, we have to confront the threat of China. We can't ignore what is happening geopolitically across the world with that. And then we have to take care of ourselves here at home, too. All those issues you talked about, housing costs, inflation, grocery bills, and runaway spending in Washington are all truly devastating problems that we have to tackle. And it's hard to prioritize one over the other. But I would say with fentanyl killing so many Americans every day, if we don't begin to take that seriously and begin to clamp down on the challenges we're facing at the southern border, then it's only going to be a problem that manifests itself in other ways.
Again, what did Barrett just offer you there? Nothing. It was just right-wing word salad. I mean, all he talked about was the southern border, which, again, is a scare tactic issue for the right wing, as I've already discussed earlier. Yes, sure, fentanyl is a problem and is killing Americans, and I think everyone is on board trying to prevent that from happening. But saying the words southern border isn't a way to actually solve really anything. Barrett mentioned China, but again, that's not offering a solution. He also mentioned inflation, which, by the way, is going down thanks to Joe Biden and the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act. In fact, we just learned this week, inflation dropped for the 12th straight month and is now around 3%. So, Tom, that's another Republican problem already being solved by Democrats. Now, let's listen to Tom Barrett's prospective Democratic challenger, former state senator Curtis Hartel, and which issues he'll be spotlighting in this campaign.
I think it's time that Washington, D.C. stops worrying about their politics and starts worrying about American families. And too often we see them fight. And so when it comes to a working class tax cut, I want to work together and make sure we get that done. Bringing our supply chains home and bringing auto jobs back to Michigan. Those are things that I care about and believe that we can get bipartisan support on. I also think it's important that we protect our kids. As somebody whose son was on Michigan State campus the day of the shooting, we have a lot more to do in terms of gun safety, and I hope we can work bipartisan to get that done as well.
Now, the audio wasn't the best there at the beginning, but Hertel said that D.C. needs to stop worrying about their politics and start worrying about American families. And so he wants to focus on a working class tax cut, bringing jobs back to Michigan, and keeping kids safe from gun violence. I mean, listening to those clips, Tom Barrett is using scary right-wing trip words like southern border, while Curtis Hertel is trying to bring jobs to Michigan and trying to keep kids safe from gun violence. So hearing all that, ask yourself this: who actually stands for something and who is fighting for something? Republicans will say we do, but you know better.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Thanks again to State Representative Betsy Kafia for being on this week. And I'd love to also thank her staff for dealing with some technical issues that I was having this week. They worked with me to ensure that we could have her on the show, and I am forever indebted to them. Coming up next week, I'm going to talk with Progress Michigan's Sam Inglot, as we'll hear about what they're focusing on this fall and beyond. By the way, Governor Whitmer passed a bill this week banning child marriage, and she also signed a bill repealing the state's cohabitation law, meaning Mississippi is the only state with such a law on the books. As I've always said, whenever you're lumped in with Mississippi, you're doing something wrong. This is what happens when you pass common sense progressive policies. And believe it or not, there were some Republicans who voted against banning child marriage and repealing the right of an unmarried couple to live together. So again, which party is really protecting children and which party is really protecting freedom? It's not the Michigan Republican Party. Join me again next week, but in the meantime, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.